Welcome to Chasing the Word on Compassion Radio. It's Monday. It is time for Chasing the Word series, and we're in the book of Ecclesiastes. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
And thank you for listening today. I know this is a holiday weekend. We're coming out of the 4th of July, so many of you are probably still on vacation. Thanks for joining us even on a vacation day. It's an important part of the book, too. This is like the crux of all of things that are happening in Ecclesiastes.
Well, we see a lot from what we've just come out of in the seasons of life. We talked about that in our last broadcast. The writer of Ecclesiastes is now going to start asking some really important questions, what those seasons look like for us.
The seasons of life. We're all going through them, and this is a season of, for many, fear, a season of death for some. It's kind of hard to see past those particular things when they loom so large in our world today. But they're no less important to God, and that's one of the big themes we've been talking about in the series. Why don't we jump in right away to that third chapter of Ecclesiastes where we left off in the last program?
Okay, we're going to begin at verse 9. What does the worker gain from his struggles? I have seen the task that God has given people to keep them occupied. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also put eternity in their hearts. But man cannot discover the work God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and enjoy the good life. It is also the gift of God. Whenever anyone eats, drinks, and enjoys all his efforts. I know that all God does will last forever. There is no adding to it or taking from it. God works so that people will be in awe of him. Whatever is, has already been. And whatever will be, already is. God repeats what has passed. That sounds a bit like a que sera, sera moment to me.
It does.
Whatever happens, happens. Continuing in verse 16. I also observed under the sun, there is wickedness at the place of judgment, and there is wickedness at the place of righteousness. I said to myself, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Since there is a time for every activity and every work, I also said to myself, this happens concerning people, so that God may test them, and they may see for themselves that they are like animals. For the fate of people and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. People have no advantage over animals, since everything is futile. All are going to the same place. All come from dust, and all return to dust. Who knows if the spirit of people rises upward and the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth? I have seen that there is nothing better than for a person to enjoy his activities, because that is his reward. For who can enable him to see what will happen after he dies?
It's an odd passage, especially in English. And I think it has to do with the language itself. The English is not really helpful in understanding how the writer of Ecclesiastes is trying to compare one thing to the other in each phrase. But what do you think is the big point he's trying to make?
He seems a bit put out that his fate is the same as anyone else's fate, or the fate of animals even. He's almost resigned to it, and it seems a very sad passage to me. It seems that he's given up all hope for a future, even after death. And that seems sad to me, because we know that as believers, we have the hope of glory. We have the hope of eternity with Christ and with God the Father. And that is one thing that we look forward to. I mean, at the beginning of the passage that I read, he says, God has also put eternity in their hearts. So he alludes to that. But then he turns right around and says, okay, the same thing that happens to animals is the same thing that's going to happen to me. I'm no different.
I think a lot of us feel like there's no heights and no depths. There's just this kind of gray going through life, especially at a time when COVID is dominating the news cycle, is dominating conversations. And truth be told, it dominates what we talk about on the radio because it's one of those big things.
Yeah.
We don't want to not take it seriously. But at the same time, we don't want to take things so seriously that we can't take God seriously. And when these things trump God's presence or his place in the room, then we are really lost. And I think about people who have lost others that can't see joy anymore. I hear stories of people who have gone through great sorrows and grief where their senses are so dulled because of their grief, they can't even smell or taste or experience life like they had before. Their mind is so dampened. Mm-hmm. I even heard of a cousin who had gone through a divorce that when it all came crashing down, he literally lost the ability to see color. He was so physically depressed that his mind was stunted for a while.
That is a weight of sadness.
It's a huge weight, and the body responds to that. Mm-hmm. I get the impression that the writer of Ecclesiastes, probably Solomon, is going through a kind of grief that he can't even put his finger on, but all he can do is express the things he can see. Maybe he lost loved ones. Maybe he lost his great lover in life, and he's a widower of sorts. Even though he has a huge number of wives and concubines as part of his estate, he doesn't have that companionship like he had before. Perhaps he's in that place of life. Whatever it is, he can't seem to escape the notion that because he's made of the same stuff as the lower animals, that he'll end up just like them.
Right.
That he can even contemplate the idea of having a feudal life is something that the animals don't experience.
Right.
As far as we know, even the dogs that have emotions that we love and are close to us don't sit around pondering their futures. They don't think, what has my life amounted to? It is a distinctive of being human to experience that sense of purpose or sense of no purpose, the sense of gain or sense of loss.
I look at this passage as someone who is speaking from great privilege. He comes from a place of great power and privilege. He's really, honestly, never physically worked a day in his life, most likely.
Yeah.
He has had a life of leisure and pleasure beyond pleasure upon pleasure.
He's already confessed to all that in the
exactly,
first couple chapters.
Exactly. And so he sits here pondering these deep thoughts. The average human being in his kingdom, and even today, doesn't really have time for.
But is it really deep? I mean, he's spilling his emotions out there, but it seems like it's going an inch deep and a mile wide. I don't sense much depth in here. I sense an outpouring of dissatisfaction or grief. And perhaps our grief needs to be deep. It needs to be plumbed. It needs to be held and actually looked at instead of just being thrown out there.
We had a conversation earlier about the grief that I am experiencing after losing my mom, talking about changes that are happening in our family with our older children all moving away from Texas, what that looks like for our future and traveling back and forth to visit them. And I just burst into tears because it felt so overwhelming. And you said to me, "It's good to see you grieve. I'm glad you're grieving." That was a hard thing for me to hear because I don't really want to grieve. I know that it's necessary and I know that it's really good for me. It just doesn't feel good when it's happening.
It's not supposed to feel good.
Well, I know. But one of the things that we see about the writer of Ecclesiastes, yes, maybe he's grieving, but it is a very selfish grief. And I want to be careful because it's not up to me to judge or determine how another person should grieve.
Right.
This doesn't seem very fruitful. And I want my grief to be fruitful. I want it to be a healing grief, if you can say, a positive grief.
What kind of things make grief positive? Or what are the positive fruits of grief that you can think of?
When you grieve in such a way that you know there's hope beyond it, there is a certain feeling of peace. I think I've experienced that peace, not just that my mom is with the Lord or that others that we know that have gone before us are with the Lord. It's not that kind of peace. It's just, it's a peace that I know hurt and turmoil and angst and anger and fear and all that is not being bottled up inside of me. Yeah. And I can release it in a way that hopefully is appropriate when it comes out. I mean, I don't want to categorize every little bit of grief that I experience because sometimes it just happens. You just cry and you're not exactly sure where it came from.
Nor does every single bit of it need to be analyzed.
Exactly. That's a place for me that I can begin to feel peace when I know that I've grieved in the right way.
You know, as a people, as a nation, as a world, there's a certain kind of unease. We might call it grief if it's come close to us, if we're afraid for the lives of people we love. You know, there are all kinds of ways we could end up in eddies of doubt that this is going to mean something or add up something positive in life. We know the scriptures say that God will work out everything for the good of those who are called according to his purpose. It's a very conditional phrase. It doesn't say everything's going to be fine.
Right.
It's saying all the stuff that's not fine, all the stuff that's wonderful, all the stuff that's in between and unexplainable. All of that stuff is going to be used by him for his purposes, for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. God's working out his plan for his purposes. Often it's not up to us to get it, to understand, or even to plumb the depths of it. And that's one of the things I think that frustrates the writer of Ecclesiastes so much.
Right.
He expects the entitlement to know everything God is up to. And it frustrates him to no end when he doesn't.
No.
Whatever grief he's going through, whatever sense of a loss he is really experiencing, the thing he's not saying is the thing I think God is trying to suss out through these scriptures. Just let the man talk. At the end of all this, we might have some more insights about what he was really going through and why God said, speak it. Why he nudged him by his spirit to write it down or to dictate it.
I think another positive thing that comes from grief, if you allow it to, is that it can help you to begin to focus on others. That's one of the things that I've really asked the Lord to help me with during this time of grief, too, is that I could not just focus inward, that I wouldn't just turn into myself and not allow myself to serve and to focus on others. And I think that we see that the writer of Ecclesiastes is doing that a lot. He's focusing on his own pain, his own hurt, his own disappointments. And when we begin to do that, we don't see a lot of positive fruit or hopefulness.
I think there's fruit in the expression that God has chosen to bless when we hurt. And he calls that lament. Lament is supposed to be an honest accounting, even a cry of despair saying, God, where were you or where are you? What will you do in this circumstance? And it's a pleading, but it's a pleading to a person that you really believe is there. Perhaps it's based in doubt. We don't know if God really is there, but oh, that he would be so he could hear me scream my dissatisfaction at him. God has said, that's the channel. Lament is the way to approach me. The other self-deceptions that we get into, trying to be nice or try to be perfect or try to not think about this bad thing, all the ways we avoid actually coming before the one who could actually tell us the truth, lament is a way for us to say, just get it out to him. Speak to him what's really truly on your heart. If it's ugly, let it be ugly, but set it to music. Let it be a thunderous clap of drum beats and angst, or let it be the quiet whimper of a cry that's petering out. Whatever it is, make it music. Don't let it be a screech and unpoetic. He's given us a talent, a skill of expression, of language that we must use, especially at times when we are at our worst. The animals don't have that. And for all the things that he's moaning about, he's still telling us we are different than the animals. We have the ability to make things better or worse for ourselves.
And to think about those things.
Dwell on them and to destroy ourselves over them or to bring them before the altar. We have that ability because God's never far from this conversation. Even while the writer of Ecclesiastes is complaining about everything, God's still in the room. And he can't escape that. Let's come back after a couple minutes here and just talk about this from a modern translation and see if any new thoughts come to that. We'll be back after this. Thank you, friends, for standing with Compassion Radio during these times of great change to our normal life. Of course, there's nothing normal about our situation, but there's also nothing normal about the kind of faith and power we find in Jesus. Compassion Radio will continue to keep bringing you encouragement from the Word, inspiring stories from the front lines of faith, and awesome opportunities to make a difference for the kingdom around the world. But we need your help right now to continue doing just that. Please take a moment today to consider how you might help us to accomplish our unique media ministry and mission. Here's how. Just visit our website, CompassionRadio.com, or call our toll-free order line, 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is Compassion Radio, P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Reach out to us whatever way works for you. And now, back to our discussion. All right, honey, we're back for part two of the program on Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going to finish this chapter together, but we always do a modern translation as well as a traditional one. So we're going to pick it up at verse 9 again in this new translation, the one that you can find available at the website as an attachment to the notes of this podcast. So if you'd like to download that study guide, please do. Again, starting at verse 9, what will it benefit the one who toils and labors at all these things? I see that God uses it all to humble man. All the things God makes are lovely in their appropriate seasons, yet it is so difficult for man to recognize God's great design. From beginning to end, the way God works out his plan is glorious, but man only sees a small part. I know that there is no use in trying to understand all God does. In this life, the best you can do is enjoy your own work and rejoice in the work of God you can see. Moreover, the very ability to appreciate the fruits of your own labor, to eat and drink happily from your own table, is in itself a gift of God. I know that all God does lasts forever and is for his own enjoyment. Nothing we could ever do could ever undo what God builds. Never fear. Everything that was, everything that will ever be, he already possesses. Even the one running far from God, he will eventually find. By the light of day, I looked in every direction and found this. Where there should have been equal justice, there was perversion of justice going on as well. Where there should have been nothing but righteousness, there was wickedness going on side by side. My heart cried out, "The righteous and the wicked he must judge." Only God in a season of justice can truly separate the good from the bad, the filthy from the pure. My heart cried out, no matter how they protest their innocence to God, he will reveal them as righteous or for the beasts that they are. And men, whether pure or beastly, will still fall the same way as the beasts of the field. When their breath leaves them for good, the body's dead and the soul sent back to God. The beasts can't stop it, neither can we. It's futile to think otherwise. All eventually go back to the place from which they came. What started as dust goes back to being dust. From what we know of men, who can tell who will ascend and who will descend like the beast forevermore? I concluded that there is no use in praising yourself for all you do in this life. You have no idea what will become of your hard work and who will eventually benefit from it. That's the end of chapter 3. Yeah, when I was doing the translating of it, it came out a little bit different nuance than the traditional style of translating this chapter. Mm-hmm. But honey, I did it from a heart of trying to pursue these words down the paths they were leading. And I'm not claiming this thing is a definitive translation by any means.
Yeah.
But I hear him calling out these things and seeing both in the same frame of reference. Whenever he sees one thing, he's comparing it. He's weighing them in his hands. He's putting them in the balance of the scales.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering what's different, what's more valuable, what's weightier than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't find that balance point. He can't see why one thing is better than the other. What is it really better to be, a man or an animal? At least the animal's ignorant of all the woes of life and that his death is coming.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, is it not the fact that we can experience pain that makes pleasure so knowable? Not just something that happens to you, but something you enter into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's talking a lot about the spiritual import of being in the moment, of experiencing things, of knowing that you are where you are, and that maybe you're not where you should be. Both those things are powerful experiences. And to know where you will be going is something that should not only give us pause, but hopefully give us hope, awareness that the time we have is precious because God gave it.
Mm.
If we don't know that something has value, we never treat it as valuable. We just go.
I think I see Solomon as someone who has never really entered into a personal relationship with God, and you allow God to speak to you. Now, we do know God said to him, because you wanted wisdom, I'm going to bless you with all this and other things as well.
Yeah.
We don't know how that conversation happened. We don't know if it was through a prophet. We don't know how it looked. But I don't get the impression after reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, especially, that Solomon had a real relationship. Relationship with God like his father did.
It is the intimacy that makes it feel like it's something of deep value.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with marriage, the way we spend time with each other, the how we go about doing it that makes us perceive that we are married,
mm-hmm.
and that we're married for good, not for ill.
Mm-hmm.
That we'll be able to stand the test of time. Those are things that we enter into by choice and by allowing ourselves to minister to each other in those hard times. Solomon's got God right there, and it seems like he's not wanting to be the junior partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always been the guy on top.
He's in control.
Maybe he just needs to be shaken up a bit and realize that he didn't initiate all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was born to the family he was born to because God allowed him to be born there. God gave him the gifts he asked for. And now later in life, he seems to resent the gifts he was given. These are tough things to have to work through, but it does seem at least like the writer here is confessing. And that's an important part of getting to a point of reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. It seems quite often that Solomon talks out of both sides of his mouth.
It does.
And he'll say, on the one hand, this is a gift from God. Everything that you have, all your life, the very breath that comes from you is a gift from God. And you should enjoy this and know and confess that it's a gift from God. And then he turns the corner almost immediately and says, it's all futile. Yeah. It's all worthless. And what's the point of it? He really seems like a tormented man. I'm convinced that he was tormented. I don't know if he was in a state of depression, if he got to a point in life where he had lived so fully on his own power that he was exhausted and couldn't see beyond his own selfishness. Yeah. You know, in these 22 verses here, he turns so many corners. It's like a maze walking through just in this one chapter.
Vacillating back and forth.
Yes, exactly.
I take some comfort from this too, because for those who feel tormented, or like they're going back and forth, or like James says in his book, like waves tossed by the wind, are always double-minded. At the same time, God honored this man so much that his book landed at the heart of the Bible. And that the words spoken in and through this man, he's not just a cautionary tale.
Right.
He's not the bad example. He's us. This man is being honored scripture, for crying out loud, his life, his history. He's right in the middle of it.
Perhaps we should look at it as a way that we can then in turn relate to God. If God so honored this man by allowing this book to be in the book, then maybe we can, like you said, find some comfort in that God will accept our prayers of lament and our crazy turning back and forth and going through the maze of life in the same way.
Yeah. He is aware and he is honoring of those he loves.
And honest when they're honest with him.
We will honestly, I think, understand what God is feeling and thinking about us if we will be honest with him and ask him to speak to us honestly. He'll give us the ears to hear it. So I would challenge you, at the same time you're confessing and getting it out of yourself and lamenting to God, thank him too for the fact that he has you in this time. For some reason, he chose this generation, the people that are hearing this program, you and I, honey, our family, our friends, our church, to be alive in times like this. He designed it that way. So he has a purpose for us. We need to cling to that truth and pray like it's a living reality and ask God to use us in the times that we're in. That's my challenge for today.
Yeah. My prayer has been that we will use this time wisely and really give it to the Lord and ask him what he wants us to learn during this time.
Thank you, friends, for joining us on this episode of Chasing the Word. It's been Chapter 3, Part 2. We'll move on to Chapter 4 next week. In the meantime, know that these words are for us, not to tell us the faults of a person or compare ourselves to the writers that God used for the Bible, but simply to find ourselves open and honest and there, present with God, and that God is speaking, and he wants us to be able to understand how much he loves us, especially at times when we need to be reminded how much we are. Thanks for joining us today on Compassion Radio. And then it crawls. Crown him the Lord of years, the potentate of time, creator of the rolling spheres, an ethically sublime. Oh, hail, Redeemer, hail, for thou hast died for me. Thy praise shall never, never fail. Remember, friends, Compassion Radio is always a coalition of the willing. Are you willing to help get out God's good news stories of the kingdom really living the gospel in the 21st century? Oh, I hope so. Compassion Radio will continue to keep bringing you encouragement from the Word, inspiring stories from the front lines of faith, and awesome opportunities to make a difference for the kingdom around the world. But we need your help right now to continue doing just that. Please take a moment today to consider how you might help us to accomplish our unique media ministry and mission. If God has enabled you to support His kingdom purposes, please give generously where you hear God's word preached, celebrated, and lived. We need you, and we thank you for everything that you do and every prayer you offer on our behalf. Let us know you're standing with us and that you're chasing the word together with us. When you call or write us today with your tax-free gift, make sure to ask for Michael O'Brien's brand new music project, Crown Him, available on CD or for digital download. Our toll-free number is 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And you can find us 24/7 at our website, CompassionRadio.com. We'll see you tomorrow.